I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now as newly elected Republican Senator Scott Brown heads to Washington to meet his colleagues in the formerly all-Democratic Massachusetts delegation. At least one Republican back here in Massachusetts says he will run against a member of that delegation. Former State Treasurer Joe Malone is considering a run against Congressman William Delahunt. And Republicans are also gearing up in Nevada, Indiana, and Wisconsin. But will Scott Brown have to mend some fences with conservatives? Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News and author of the network's blog, The Note. First, Rick, where else are you seeing embers ignite because of the Brown win?
You know, there's a couple of Senate races that are good opportunities. Tommy Thompson, the former governor of Wisconsin, is making noises about running against Russ Feingold in Wisconsin. The lieutenant governor of Nevada may jump in as a Republican against Harry Reid. Mike Pence, congressman from Indiana, is talking about running statewide to challenge Evan Bayh. He's meeting with some officials in Washington today. The case that can be made to any Republican now is that you can tap into something real out there. Republicans are more confident than they've ever been about the prospects of winning back the House and making big gains in the Senate. That has a big motivating factor on both donors and potential candidates.
Well, some would say that was going to happen anyway, and it typically does, you know, after a victory like Obama's. But President Obama gave an interview to ABC's George Stephanopoulos, very respectful of Massachusetts voters, saying legislators should move quickly to coalesce around elements of the health care reform package that both sides agree on. You report that Jake Tapper of ABC says maybe the president gave away a little too much in his conversation.
Yeah, he talked a little bit about the health care strategy, and the comments that he made to George Stephanopoulos were pretty clear that they're thinking about a piecemeal approach that just takes a couple of pieces of health care reform, maybe some of the insurance regulations that are very popular, and work with that and take out some of the things that aren't popular. We're not quite that far along in the negotiations, but clearly the prospects of quick action are gone now that Democrats have lost this seat and that Democrats nationwide are worried about the potential for more losses.
Well, Republicans are sweating a little bit, too. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said if you're a Republican in a red state, don't think this can happen to you. Yesterday, the Tea Party Nation put out its statement that its next target is a Republican running for Obama's old seat who isn't conservative enough for them. And yesterday, Glenn Beck attacked Scott Brown after Brown, in his acceptance speech, said his daughters were available. Here's Beck with sidekicks on his radio program with some of his reaction to that.
I want a chastity belt on this man. I want his every move watched in Washington. I don't trust this guy. No, I'm just telling you.
It's just a creepy moment.
No,
it is.
This one could end with a dead intern.
He's trying to come up with
this one could end with a dead intern.
Well, the dead intern, presumably Chandra Levy, the young woman with links to Congressman Gary Condit. Her suspected killer was arraigned last year. Later on his show, Beck was far more somber and said he also didn't trust Scott Brown because of a nude photo Brown took in 1982 that some conservatives across the country are just getting to see. Now, voters here in Massachusetts didn't seem to care about that. But do you think that there are more fissures in the Republican Party than are clear at first?
No question. And this national embrace that we've seen of Scott Brown from Republicans overlooks the fact that he is a conservative by Massachusetts standards, but really isn't by national standards. The fact that he doesn't want to overturn Roe v. Wade is not likely to be looked upon favorably by 2012 presidential primary voters on the Republican side, for instance. There is so much energy and anger out there. All of that Tea Party movement that we're seeing out there, it threatens Republicans as much as it does Democrats, particularly in primaries. And there's a couple of big ones that are coming up, particularly one in Florida for the Senate, where you know the more mainstream and maybe the better general election candidate is being threatened by a grassroots conservative. I think that's in part reflected in those Beck comments that you played. Incumbents of any stripe are in danger in 2010.
Well, Rick, we just want to ask you briefly about a Supreme Court ruling today that corporations can freely spend money to support or oppose political candidates. This is the case that was brought by the corporation that made that anti-Hillary Clinton movie. But in the decision, the justices also struck down part of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance bill that had previously barred corporate pay, but also union ads. So they're now free. What do you see coming of this?
It's going to open the floodgates. Some people talking about maybe $1 trillion in spending by big entities that are going to be able to participate in campaigns in much more explicit ways than they have before. A lot of the campaign finance reform advocates, people that liked McCain-Feingold, for instance, they are really upset with this decision. It is going to vastly change the playing field.
Oh, no. More ads than we here in Massachusetts just saw. Impossible. Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, author of that network's blog, The Note. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Well, our next conversation may not be for everyone or for little ones. We're seeing the first of Tiger Woods since last November. The golfer was photographed by the National Enquirer outside a Mississippi sexual addiction clinic. Author and recovering sex addict Benoit Denise Lewis is familiar with that facility, the Pine Grove Behavioral Health and Addiction Services in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. He researched it for a book and wrote on his blog that a source confirmed that Woods was there. Denise Lewis described the sex addiction program to ESPN.
You know, you got homework, you got intense group therapy sessions. Basically, these treatment centers are trying to get you to sit with uncomfortable feelings, mm-hmm. sit with all the feelings that you were using your addiction to not deal with.
Well, we first spoke with Denise Lewis about addiction when his book, American Anonymous, 8 Addicts in Search of a Life, first came out. In it, he tracks 8 addicts addicted to alcohol, heroin, food, shoplifting, and, as he is, to sex. He writes of staying awake day and night.
1:15. Spend 5 hours online looking for someone attractive to have sex with. Ignore repeated calls from friend with whom I have plans. 6:17 p.m. Call friend, lie about why I can't meet. 6:20. Go back online. Eventually find someone attractive to have sex with. 7:20. Drive an hour to meet the person. Wait. Person doesn't show. 9:40. Get back online. Look for someone new. 10:02. Mom calls. Let it go to voicemail. 10:45. Have phone sex. 12:45 a.m. Remember that I hate phone sex. Resolve to stop having phone sex. 12:46 a.m. Feel shame. 1:08 a.m. Check mom's message. Realize that I forgot her birthday. 1:09 a.m. Feel like killing myself.
And that's a functioning sex addict. Let's revisit that conversation. When we spoke with Benoit Denise Lewis, I asked him why he talks so openly about his own addiction, because the whole underpinning of recovery is supposed to be anonymity.
Yeah, well, it's one of the arguments that I make in the book. I mean, we have so much shame around addiction. You know, for years, the millions of Americans who have had successful long-term recovery have been talking to each other, you know, in church basements. One of the results of that is that there has been no advocacy movement around addiction. There have been no people out there saying, you know what, we need to start thinking about this differently.
Someone in your book says, imagine if we had, as the breast cancer survivors do, you know, recovering addicts all dressing in pink and marching on Washington.
Right. And that may be the next step here, because we really need to start rethinking the way that we look at addiction. Addiction is a public health problem. And yet, we don't think about addiction in that way. When's the last time a presidential candidate was asked in a debate what their thoughts were about addiction and recovery? It just never happens.
Right. Well, let's bring in one of the addicts that you follow. He's Jody Pegram. He's the executive director of a Sober Way home in Prescott, Arizona, and a recovering addict with addictions to heroin, crack, prescription drugs, gambling, nicotine. Jody, did I leave anything out?
Probably.
Well, Jody, first, you know, you're very upfront. You give your real name. Most of the addicts in Benoit's book don't. What do you think about Benoit's premise? Well, an anonymity, you know, may help people to get into those rooms in the beginning. It may be cutting down on what we could be doing for addicts because we don't know how many they are and who they are.
Well, it's tough because it's such a balancing act, because anonymity alone, it's a spiritual principle that was never really designed to be this right for privacy, even though that's the way a lot of us in recovery take it. You know, it was really about monitoring our own ego.
You're saying making sure no one was better than anyone else. Well, Benoit, you take us into a world of addiction that's far deeper than many may have known about. Janice is a crack-addicted grandmother. Then there's Todd, married to a woman. He has body dysmorphia, which means he can't really see his body for what it is, which is huge. He's become a bodybuilder, addicted to steroids. He pays for the steroids by prostituting himself to men who are attracted specifically to overly muscular bodybuilders. Then there's also Kate, a young mom who's addicted to shoplifting. Ellen, a food addict who ate enough for a family of three. Sean, a college-age sex addict. But, you know, I can hear people saying, wait a minute, crack, I understand. But sex, is that really an addiction?
There was a real division 5 or 10 years ago. A lot of researchers and scientists who studied addiction said, you know what, drugs and alcohol, those are addictions. But, you know, these things like sex and overeating, we can't call these things addictions because there's no substance being ingested. Now, the more we look inside the brains of sex addicts and gamblers and food addicts, they're seeing real similarities to the brains of drug addicts and alcoholics.
Well, for now, sex addiction is not listed as a disorder in the main manual used by mental health professionals. But you spoke with addiction expert Patrick Carnes, who said, you know, he thinks that more and more teens in particular could be called sex addicts. Why?
The Internet. The Internet is really turned a lot of people who did not really struggle with sex addiction so much into sex addicts. I mean, I wrote a piece in the New York Times writing about my own addiction. The hundreds of emails that I got from some women, mostly men all across the country, husbands who couldn't stop sneaking away while their wife was asleep to go into the den and couldn't stop looking at pornography and said, why can't I stop this? I'm so able to, you know, be successful and to control myself in all other areas of my life. I feel like I have an addiction to this. The Internet is really changing
things. Well, and you need to say, I mean, here's Sean, this young kid. Someone said to him he'd get addicted, you know, he'd become a sex addict, I'm trying to remember, and he said, wow, wouldn't that be great? He thought, well, that would be great. What would be wrong with that? How horrible is it? Because it's horrible for him and for you.
Yeah.
How horrible is it?
It's, you know, it's interesting. I'll tell some people, it tends to be married heterosexual men, I'll say, you know, I'm a sex addict. And they say, well, if we could all be so lucky, yeah, you know, that yeah, we can be having all this sex. And sex addiction, like any addiction, is completely debilitating. It turns me into a person who is incredibly selfish. It blocks virtually all the good from coming out of me because I'm spending so much time in this pursuit of this one thing, which invariably makes me miserable. You know, I can pretend like everything's okay. I tend to get my work done on time, so I can pass. You know, there are some drug addicts who really can't. You know, for Janice, she was on the street living in crack houses. I can pass as being okay. But inside, I'm dead.
Right. And it's so hard to get away from it. Sean, this young kid you profile who bounces from recovery to recovery, you know, he can't even buy a cell phone that doesn't have internet access when he wants to keep himself from...
Right. He has to go through a lot of hoops, and I've had that same thing, go through a lot of hoops to find a cell phone without internet access so he can't look at online
right.
porn.
Well, let's bring Jody back in, again, executive director of A Sober Way Home in Prescott, Arizona, and a recovering addict himself. You know, Jody, while people debate what addiction is, you seem to have a pretty simple way of describing, in your mind, what's an addiction?
What I look at is the quality of your life. And if it's negative, is it a result of, you know, a substance, the sex, the gambling, the eating? And if that's the case, and you've tried to, you know, correct it by not doing it with failure, you need some help. If you want to call that an addiction, if you want to call it a disease, it really doesn't matter.
That's Jody Pegram of A Sober Way Home in Arizona. Before that, Benoit Denizet-Lewis, author of America Anonymous, who, by the way, points out that for some it does matter what you call sex addiction. They say if you call it a disorder, well, then sex offenders may be able to escape punishment. We're going to take a break and have more with both men in 1 minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. And if you've just joined us, this conversation may not be for little ones. It's about addictions. Golfer Tiger Woods has kept a pretty low profile since allegations about his infidelity came to light. And the tabloid, the National Enquirer, has now published photos, it says, are of Woods entering a treatment center for sex addiction in Mississippi. Well, author and recovering sex addict Benoit Denizet-Lewis researched that center and others for his book, America Anonymous, 8 Addicts in Search of a Life. And one of those addicts, Jody Pegram, now executive director of A Sober Way Home in Prescott, Arizona, had a number of substance abuse problems. We're revisiting our conversation with Benoit and Jody, who had a fragile recovery. During it, he met a psychiatrist who prescribed Adderall for what he thought was attention deficit disorder, and the doctor told Jody it wasn't addictive. So I asked Jody what happened next.
I got addicted. You know, that's it is addictive, and everybody knows that now.
It happened to you again after another stretch of recovery. when you had excruciating pain, which turned out to be kidney stones, how frightened were you at that point to take the medication that you needed to take?
You know, I was terrified. You know, you're always a step away or a pill away or, you know, whatever it is away from really waking up that lion, if you will.
Yeah, and I remember, I was following Jody through the kidney stones, and Jody was really scared. And I think Jody's story is so fascinating on a number of levels. One, both Jody and Bobby, who's a heroin addict in South Boston, and his brother is actually addicted to OxyContin. Through both of their stories, I'm able to explore a little bit an important new trend, and that's prescription drugs. I mean, illegal drugs in this country continue to decline. We're actually using fewer illegal drugs. Well, people have just replaced that with prescription drugs. I mean, if we really want a war on drugs, it should be a war on prescription drug abuse. It's skyrocketing.
Well, you know, speaking about prescription medication, Jody, Benoit also explores this debate about which is the better for recovery, the new medications that are coming along that help addicts curb their desire for alcohol and drugs, or straight AA support groups therapies, you know, no meds recoveries. Your thoughts on that?
It's really about working in concert with, you know, the 12-step movement. If there's some medications that can help with cravings, and as you start to bring it all together, you're really going to ultimately get the most effective result.
Yeah, and the pharmaceutical industry right now is really excited by the prospect of whether they can do for addiction what they did for depression. I really throw a little caution to the wind here that you know, science has been about to save us from addiction for the last 200 years. I mean, we have always been making progress, and there are those who claim that we're this close to really understanding what's going on in the brain. And if you take this pill, this is the magic bullet. So, you know, while all of this science is very exciting and it may really change the way we treat addiction, we're not there yet.
Well, meanwhile, Benoit, as we get to the end of your book, you begin to ask, you know, what am I doing? Here you are, an addict, climbing into eight other addicts' heads, and you start to wonder why you're going near these things that are such triggers for you. But it does seem as if one thing you all get out of your reporting is the friendship. So, Jody, back to this idea of getting rid of anonymity. Do you agree with Benoit's call to stand shoulder to shoulder and step up and claim this illness?
You know, I don't want to do anything against the 12-step programs. They're great. They are the foundation of recovery. They saved my life. At the same time, I really wish more people would step up and say, look, this is my story. Because for me to be an addict, to get well, there's something I have to do. I have to admit there's a problem. And in order for this country to really have major changes, it's going to have to do the same thing.
Well, and Benoit, you may not get the million-person march that you're hoping for, but you do have actor David Duchovny admitting to sex addiction. There have been people admitting to shoplifting addictions. And even if you have a march calling for more research and rehab places, it won't change a factor you say you found. You say you can trace the problems of addicts to childhood abuse. Jody's dad was an alcoholic who left the family. But, Benoit, you didn't seem to find that in your family.
It's complicated with me. I adore both of my parents now, and they're two of my best friends. I grew up with a mother who never once said she loved me, never hugged me. I grew up feeling incredibly alone. And now this is not to say, because everyone says, oh, you're blaming your parents. There are plenty of people who don't feel love from their parents who don't grow up to become addicts. So I'm not saying that there's a definite, that happened, my mom didn't do this, and suddenly I'm an addict. But it's clear when we look at addicts and you look at the eight people that I wrote about in my book, seven of them had serious trauma growing up, whether that was sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional neglect, parents who were unrecovered addicts. The role of childhood abuse and trauma on any level throughout one's lifetime is critical. And a lot of times we sort of skip over that, and because it's sort of seen as an excuse if you're talking about that, well, you're blaming your past, just move on. It's not about blaming our past. It's about honestly looking at whatever happened to us and trying to heal that. Because if that remains unhealed and unlooked at, it's going to pop into your life in different ways, right, in different negative ways.
We also should mention young gay people. You have you speak to an expert who reminds us that imagine if heterosexual children were forced to date and go to the prom with people of the same sex, which is essentially what happens to young gay boys and girls. They're forced to interact with people they don't want to interact with.
And interact in that way.
When they're sort of hiding their sexuality.
I mean, we know that rates of substance abuse are higher among young gay men than among young heterosexuals. And this we can clearly look at as trauma. It's still, for many people, inherently traumatic to grow up. What do you learn as a gay kid growing up in this culture? You learn compartmentalization. You learn how to lie. You learn how to pass. You learn that you can't trust other people with the truest of who you are. So we do see higher rates of substance abuse. Fortunately, as this country and the world becomes less homophobic and more accepting, I think that's going to change.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A recent poll from the National Association of Colleges and Employers found that nearly two-thirds of college seniors are worried about finding a job. Well, they probably don't go to Thomas College in Waterville, Maine. The small liberal arts school guarantees a job to students who are unable to keep a certain grade point average and fulfill other requirements. If within 6 months of graduating, students can't find work in their fields, they can come back to Thomas to take classes for free or have the college pay their student loans for a year. Thomas Edwards is provost of Thomas College. Dr. Edwards, welcome.
Thank you.
And we understand you've had this Guaranteed Job Placement Program, or GJOB, for about 10 years. Explain it further. How does it work?
When students come to Thomas, we have them sign a contract with the college, and we ask them to get a good GPA, to do an internship, and in return, we're going to guarantee that they're going to get that first job right out of college.
And we should say one of the requirements I find interesting, they have to be in good financial standing with both you, the school, and student loan agencies. So, you know, you're sort of asking them to be fiscally responsible before this happens.
Right. If they've got a large outstanding bill for the college, then we're not going to turn around and start to pay back on that. But we generally find that 95% of our students find a position 6 months outside of their graduation date. So in the past 10 years of the program, we've only had to pay out six times. And of those six times, five have been payouts in the sense that students have come back to get more education at the graduate level, oftentimes looking to move in a different career path. They may have studied business before and want to move into education or vice versa.
Well, we understand you've got about 650 undergrad students at a time, 400 graduate and continuing ed students. About 80% of your students come from Maine. So what kinds of fields do they get their jobs in?
We have about 40 to 50% of our students tend to be in the traditional areas of business, in accounting, in marketing, in finance. But we also have a large number of students who are in education, they're in tech fields, they're in criminal justice and sport management. And so they tend to find jobs that match up pretty well with what their career choices were when they started out.
And how much do they work with the school to find those jobs? In other words, does your career placement office become more important since you've made this guarantee?
That's right. The guarantee tends to be really important, especially for families. Students sometimes, when they're 18 years old and looking at a school, aren't thinking about 4 years out. But families certainly are, especially when they're looking at the investment that college education means.
Well, as you said, you require that these candidates have an internship, but you also help them with other things towards getting a job, like writing resumes. Do you do things like that as well?
Sure, we do resumes. We have career services sponsors, everything ranging from etiquette dinners to interview techniques.
Etiquette dinners?
Oh, yes. We bring students in and we have them sit for a five-course meal. We talk to them about etiquette at dining and interviews and all those kinds of things.
I'm wondering, too, as we said, if students can't find these jobs after 6 months, they can come back and take an unlimited number of tuition-free courses for up to 2 years, or have the school pay their student loans. Now, we understand tuition's around $19,000. 94% of students or so get some financial aid. So this is a big deal. You have never had a student fake not getting a job or not try to get a job just so they can get their student loans paid?
No, we've never really encountered any problems along those lines. Students aren't interested in coming back necessarily to college. They want to get on with their lives, and so this is looking at a Thomas College education as the first step for them to get off and running.
Well, as you said, you had tremendous success, but now the times have changed. There's a recession. Are you having any more trouble placing students?
There were some fears out there that we might see an uptick in the number of students that were going to claim some reimbursement of the program. We really haven't seen that. I think it's a factor both of the kind of education that our students get and the fact that they work pretty closely with career services and working on landing those internships.
Do you think this is something that colleges fall down on, you know, the idea of really concentrating on job as an end game?
I think that it can be if it takes a traditional liberal arts education and takes it too much into the realm of vocational training. If I get trained in a very narrow field, I could run into trouble. More than ever, I think the liberal arts education is really what's necessary to keep up with the way the environment is changing.
That's Dr. Thomas Edwards, provost for Thomas College in Waterville, Maine, talking about the school's Guaranteed Job Placement Program, or GJOB. Qualified students who don't get placed in a job within 6 months of graduation can come back and take classes or have their student loans paid off. Dr. Edwards, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure.
Okay, just ahead, the cash crunch in Haiti. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. With more than 1,000 planes carrying emergency supplies still waiting to land in Haiti, the U.S. military has opened a third alternate airport in the Dominican Republic to try to get much-needed food, water, and medical supplies from there to neighboring Haiti. Medical clinics there have 12-day patient backlogs, and some doctors on the ground say as many as 20,000 people a day who could be saved by surgery may die each day. Dr. John Angus is at a hospital which has received supplies from U.S. soldiers, but it still isn't enough.
What we do need, really, is supply. Supply casting, metal plates to help put the bones together.
And here in the U.S., Haitian Americans have been desperate to send money to relatives in the earthquake zone. A third of all Haitians rely on cash from overseas in the form of remittances that relatives send via banks or money transfer agencies such as Western Union. But the earthquake leveled many banks and transferred agencies, and the flow of cash to desperate survivors has been cut off. Well, here now is Meghna Chakrabarty, spoke to some Haitian Americans this morning at the Mattapan neighborhood of Boston. A line snaked out the door as people at the Unitransfer agency tried to wire money.
Everybody here who have paid it.
Yes.
Right now they suffer. I think they need help from us, you know, that's why they're here.
Is the line usually this long here?
Only two days, because there are many people try to send some, you know?
Yeah.
Because the transfer doesn't open a few days in Haiti. They open today. Some of them open today. They try to send.
Do you have family still in Haiti?
Yeah, I have family in Haiti.
So you're sending money to them today?
Yeah, I'm going to send money for a few of them. You going to help me to bring somebody here now?
I don't know how to do that.
So my husband is from Haiti.
Your husband's from Haiti?
And family through him, who I've met because I visited. So they're sleeping in the park right now, and they have not seen food nor water as yet. But, you know, they're still asking, yeah, to send a little something. So when things probably, I don't know what the total situation is, but I guess maybe there might be opportunity soon, hopefully, to buy something or to maybe move on to another part of the country. So that's why we're sending something down.
And have you transferred money down there before?
No, today's the first time since the earthquake, because we understand that this particular agency is getting through to Port-au-Prince. I should have been here at 9 because I knew they opened at 9 and I knew it would be a long line, most likely, because everybody probably is doing the same thing.
The sounds of Haitian Americans in Boston today. Well, joining us from Florida is Jean-Marc Piquillon, a vice president at Unitransfer, which is a unit of Unibank, Haiti's largest commercial bank. And Jean-Marc, we know you spoke with banking officials in Haiti this morning, so give us the latest. Are banks open? Are people able to get cash?
At this time, many banks have opened throughout the country, but it's mostly in the provincial areas. And as of this morning, many banks in Port-au-Prince are not open, and they are scheduled to reopen on Saturday.
So the banks aren't open, but how about transfer companies like yours? Are you able to get money from here to Haiti and from Haiti and into the hands of Haitians?
At this time, we were able to resume our operations throughout the country as of Tuesday. Mm-hmm. We opened throughout the provinces and in select locations in Port-au-Prince. Many of our locations were damaged and inoperable. However, we were able to open about approximately 6 locations in Port-au-Prince, and more are coming on online today as we are speaking.
So Unitransfer has some places that are open. We understand $2 billion in total in remittances flows into Haiti every year. That's almost a fifth of Haiti's gross domestic product. How badly do Haitians rely on it?
I can tell you that it is a very important part of the Haitian life, and it is pretty much the life force for most Haitian families in Haiti. So to us, it was a very important part for us to resume operation, to make sure that a lot of our customers, a lot of our family, a lot of our friends, a lot of the Haitian people can resume their daily livelihood by receiving cash. And as a result, we also decided to remove all transfer fees for the families here to make sure that they're able to send even more to their families in Haiti.
Yeah.
So until further notice, there are no fees when you send money through UniTransfer to your family in Haiti.
Well, and it's wonderful that you've been able to restart at least some offices, but how difficult is it still for people to get some of this remittance money because, we're talking about thousands of people in only a few offices and only a few places?
I can tell you that it is a very, very difficult operation because, as we said, the banks have not reopened yet, and even for our operation, since we are a subsidiary of a bank, we are able to find cash. But due to the fact that only a few locations are open, it's becoming very difficult because we usually have a very wide network throughout the country, over 250 points of pickup, and that's throughout the country. And in Port-au-Prince, we've had a very wide network. Now we have been reduced to 6, and we're trying to increase our network. So hopefully by the end of the week and maybe tomorrow, we can have many points to provide relief to those in desperate need in Haiti right now.
Well, we know Haitians live on average on $2 a day, so it's not as if they need a lot of money, but any money is, as you said, in some cases hard to get. Before the earthquake, you noticed a decline in how much money people could send home.
Well, there was a decline based on the economy here, and a lot of people were jobless, so the entire remittance industry was seeing a downturn based on that. The average money transfer had gone down in most of the markets, Latin America and the Caribbean. But I would assume that I'm expecting that over the next few months there's going to be increase in Haiti based on the need that's there right now.
Yeah, we understand the average transaction dropped from about 160 a month to about 140 a month before the earthquake. Well, we want you to get back to your good work, but we understand, Jean-Marc, that you are also helping people with cell phone minutes. How so?
Right. The most important part right now is people want to be in touch with their families, and it's been very difficult for them to do that since the cell phone operators, the cell phone companies have been up and down. Many of them are becoming stable right now. I believe that communication is being reestablished throughout the country. However, people are not able to put minutes on their phones. They don't have the money, and they don't have the locations to top up their phones or put minutes on their phones. So we provide a service to the main cellular phone companies, where you could stop by any of our offices and put minutes for your family in Haiti. It's been a very, very big service that we've been providing to the community, and people are flooding through our offices to make sure that they're able to provide their families for minutes so that they can call for help if they need any help.
And this is a free service you're providing?
Absolutely. If you put $10, you receive the corresponding amount in local dollars.
Right, no fee. That's Jean-Marc Piquion, Vice President at UniTransfer, a unit of Haiti's largest commercial bank. And I just want to ask you about your family. We understand your dad was in Haiti when the earthquake hit. He is out, but your mom's still there. Do you know how she is or how your other relatives are?
To be honest, I've heard from them, a few of them. There's some of them that I have not heard from. My immediate family is okay. Some of them are severely injured and some of them are recovering. And other extended family members I haven't heard from, and we're still waiting to hear word from them.
Yeah. Well, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Again, Jean-Marc Piquion of UniTransfer. And just a reminder, you can download a podcast of this story at hereandnow.org. You can also always follow us on Twitter at hereandnow. And I forgot to send a tweet today. We'll do right now. You're listening to Here and Now. If you've seen the 2000 film Chocolat, you might recognize this classic tune. It's Minor Swing by the late guitarist Jean-Baptiste Django Reinhardt. 100 years ago this week, Saturday to be precise, legend has it that Django was born in a Belgian gypsy caravan that settled near Paris. He quickly took to the violin, the banjo, and the guitar. He began performing in Paris dance halls at the age of 12, and despite terribly burning his hand at 18, he became renowned on the guitar, recording with Louis Armstrong, Coleman Hawkins, and, of course, the great violinist Stephen Grappelli. This week, there are celebrations of Django Reinhardt's centennial in New York, New Orleans, Minneapolis, and Saturday at the Alliance Française, that's the French Library here in Boston, which is where our guests come in. That's Hindustan, performed by the band Sinti Rhythm, Sinti being the name of Reinhardt's gypsy tribe. Robert Saunders and Jack Saref are members of Sinti Rhythm. They join us. Jack would be the one with the guitar over there. Jack, welcome.
Hello. Thanks.
And Robert, the guitar over here. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
I just want to start by saying I've used the word gypsy several times in discovering Django Reinhardt, and we know that that's a word that many Roma people don't like because it can have a pejorative overtone. We just learned that gypsy came about because Europeans believed this wandering tribe was from Egypt. So
right,
gypsy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But Jack, tell us, first of all, what did the Sinti people that Django was born into, what did they think about that phrase? So we use the right one.
I think they prefer to be referred to as the Sinti, but the word gypsy is certainly not something they have any discomfort with. They're are Sinti gypsies using band names like Gypsy Project, yeah, the Gypsy Kids?
Well, the name of your band is the Sinti Rhythm. And Sinti, again, the name of this tribe, that legend had it actually came from India.
Yes, I think the connection between the Sinti and other tribes coming originally from India or near Pakistan, it has been based on linguistic studies, mostly, and connections with the Romanesh language and Sanskrit, I believe.
And here's Django Reinhardt born into this group. I mean, it just sounds like a story that's too good to be true. Was his mother really an acrobat and a dancer in this wandering gypsy tribe?
Yes, absolutely. These were families of performers. His mother would also make money fortune-telling, reading palms.
And Robert, where does your interest? I mean, we know he became this great guitarist, but where does your interest come in him? I mean, how did it come to this?
I first heard Django on, I think it was a UNESCO record when I was in my 20s, and that's a generation ago, and I couldn't believe the elaborate embellishments and the blazing speed which he could play.
So now here we have this group, Sinti Rhythm, and we understand you not only play Django Reinhardt's music, but as many of his devotees do, you play music through his prism.
Yes,
absolutely. For sure. That's a good way of putting it. We play selections that Django never actually performed, but do it in the way that he would have.
Why don't you give us an example of that, Robert? I believe you're going to play Stomping at the Savoy.
Yes, and Jack does the lead work on this.
Robert Saunders and Jack Saref of the Gypsy Jazz Quartet, Sinti Rhythm, playing Stompin' at the Savoy as Django Reinhardt might have played it. Now tell me, because we heard, too, about his affliction, what happened to his hand. How did that happen, by the way?
Well, accounts differ, but basically what happened was that when he was putting out a candle, the flame fell upon some of the celluloid flowers that his wife had been making to sell in the market, and a conflagration broke out. A large portion of his body was burned, including digits on his left hand, his fretting hand,
yeah,
and two sort of clawed fingers, his ring finger and his pinky, which he could only employ to bar the strings.
In other words, to lay across.
And, that's exactly right, and so used his index finger and his middle finger to do all his mobile fret changing.
Many of the young Sinti, when they're studying this music from birth, this music is almost sort of a religious experience for a lot of the Sinti. We'll begin learning Django's solos with two fingers and the shape of his hand, because the two digits that were paralyzed.
Again, the pinky and the ring finger. You're holding your hand
up. I'm sorry. He could use those on the top couple strings and just sort of place them there. So a lot of the chord voicings we play are based on the shape of Django's hand.
Well, let's hear more of your playing. Jack, you have a traditional Hebrew song, David. This is with Robert Saunders on lead. Let's listen. What else did he do to change sound? Because Stephen Crapelli is one of many who says, you know, he made jazz guitar possible. What? Why?
Well, before him, there weren't many guitarists playing melodies with the freedom that he did. I mean, he would take these glissandos that only Louis Armstrong was doing, and he'd translate them to the guitar. He'd play these amazing arabesque lines.
Give me an example.
Sure. These little chromatic runs that go the entire length of the guitar.
And Robert, that rhythm line that you were playing, it's very driving, very chopping. Let's hear that. And as you're playing the music, I mean, just your thoughts again on what it is that's compelling his many fans.
Oh, I can tell you right now, to me, it is redolent of the circus. It's like a trapeze artistry or a high wire act or something. I mean, the incredible virtuosity shown by this man and a love of American jazz, that's what drives his sound to me.
Well, it's so fitting that you say it feels like a circus,
it
given
is.
He's the son of an acrobat.
Oh, yeah.
Robert Saunders, Jack Soroff, how about playing us out with a classic Django Reinhardt? What would it be, Jack?
Sure, we're going to play arguably his best-known tune, Nuage, which means clouds.